Hey, Wonderfuls, welcome to episode 355 of the podcast. I just wrapped it up today here at SF Sketchfest. I was very lucky to be able to record remotely with Julia Prescott, Maximum Fun's own Julia Prescott, at the Maximum Fun studio. So we did it without being able to look into each other's beautiful eyes, but it was such a joy. You can check out Julia's wonderful podcast that she also has on the Maximum Fun Network around Springfield. You can follow her at Julia Prescott on the social medias. And I had such a great time having this conversation. I feel you'll have a great time listening to it. I'm hoping to see some of you at SF Sketchfest. I've said it before, I'll say it again in this intro. It is happening, my friends. If you are listening to this on the day this episode drops, we have opened as of today. Our opening night shows are happening Thursday, January 9th. I will be at Maria Bamford at the Castro Theater tonight. I am so excited to see her beautiful face and hear her beautiful comedy. And lots of great shows throughout the next weeks to come. You can go to sfsketchfest.com for more information. Lots of Maximum Fun and Maximum Fun adjacent shows happening, so check those out. And I will talk to you soon. In Hollywood.
Yeah, Hollywood, California.
Oh, I was talking about Hollywood, Florida.
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
that
this is awkward.
As well. Okay. I was thinking Paris, Texas.
Oh, so many, so very many like highfalutin cities in Europe that have been given. It feels almost like the version of kind of the joke that happens. I think it was probably a Twitter meme as well, or an Instagram meme, but like all of the places in Los Angeles that are these really crummy apartment complexes that have the most highfalutin
absolutely.
Names. And it's sort of, it feels a little like that. Like it feels like no one could have imagined how ironic calling Paris, Texas would be to call it Paris, Texas. And yet, And I listen, no offense to Hollywood, Florida, where I'm not sure I've even been there, but like how many places are there in the United States that are named after like a gorgeous city that also have their own beautiful architectural merits?
I know. It makes me think of, I used to intern on the Fox lot when I was in college and lived with my mom in the Valley. And so I would drive from North Hollywood to Fox and take Coldwater. And I remember passing one sign that was like, Beverly Hills, sister city, Cannes, France. And I was like, sure, why not? Like, make that happen. Whatever makes you feel better.
Absolutely. No, you're right. I forgot too that there is that, the sort of like, what's the sister city of Minneapolis? What's
but
the
also,
sister city?
Like, what's the deal with sister cities? Not to be immediately Jerry Seinfeld, but like,
no,
like it's sort of like the weird sort of godfather godmother pact. It's like, what do you do?
That's right. That's
what
right. What are your responsibilities? I do feel like there was, now that you say that, I feel like there was a podcast episode. Every conversation now when someone's trying to remember something involves them hearing a podcast that they can no longer define. But I do feel like there was something I heard about, like where that actually came into play, where someone's sister, like it was an exchange student situation where someone's sister city was like, there was some sort of exchange student association where, you know, whereby like these kids from this town went to this town in France because it's a sister city. And and this sister city tried to help out its sister city when times were tough. So maybe there is some sort of compact, some contract
that I'm
not aware of.
Yeah. Though that does feel like a sitcom premise where it's like, you know, now the sister city's in trouble and we have to go and leap into action and save them
That's
or something. And it feels so fantastical. Anyway,
let me ask you this.
Yes.
And of course, coincidentally, I asked this of all my guests, so it's funny you would bring it up. If you were a town, what would your sister city be?
Ooh. Well, I think I have a good answer for this. I just recently, last September, visited Amsterdam for the first time with my husband. And it was, I'd never really done the Euro trip thing except for Ireland when I was 13. And that was like, you know, a big theater kid trip. So that was its own category. But then we decided to go to London, Dublin, and Amsterdam. And so Amsterdam was like the last stop on this like 3-city tour. And the moment we touched ground there, I don't know if it was because it was the last place we were going to and we were so exhausted or what, but it was just so clean and beautiful and quaint. And, you know, like you have the canals, but then you have these like really historic buildings. And I love like a real like cozy side street with cobblestones.
Oh, yeah.
And there were like, yes, you know, indeed, flowers everywhere. It was just like everything I wanted. People were riding bikes. And so I immediately was like, well, if I wasn't doing this whole Hollywood thing, I think we would just uproot and go over there and have a great old time.
Oh, yeah.
So that's my sister city.
That's a wonderful answer. I have to admit to you that I too have not been to Amsterdam other than to change planes in Amsterdam because it does seem that there are good prices to get yourself from the United States to Amsterdam and then go on to another place. And it was never an intention for me to sort of skip over Amsterdam except for that. But it just hasn't happened yet. But I think I'm going to feel the same way just based on everything I know about it as a city and you know, just photos and also like I love Copenhagen a great deal. And I've heard people say like, oh, there are some similarities between the cities.
Yeah, so I can see that too. And my thing too, and I feel so naive in saying this, but like, you know, the reputation that Amsterdam has, when I came back, I was like, and I didn't even try the weed. Like that was sort of my barometer for success. I was like, I didn't even need to be high. I don't think we could have been
sex.
Even consider it, but we were so like running from bus to bus that I was like, if we were high, this would be terrible. But
right.
It was,
well, also
great.
We live in California.
Sorry
to interrupt. I was just saying, now that we live in California, it is a bit like, oh yeah, well that's not that unusual.
Yeah,
now we're getting
that's just
used
what I
to
do
the
back
idea
home
of just being able to cannabis everywhere. Yeah. Now, couple questions. Number one, did you visit isn't there a place in Amsterdam also, and I say also because Copenhagen has one, that's sort of like, this section is where the anarchists live and there's no law?
Oh, no. I didn't even know that existed over there. I mean, I will say also my time in Amsterdam was very brief because my priority, and I'm not ashamed to say this, my priorities traveling usually revolve around some kind of theme park type thing.
So
I've dragged my husband to Tokyo Disney and Disneyland Paris, and there was this
nice
one. It was so great. But there's this one theme park an hour outside of Amsterdam called Efteling, which is like a Disney caliber park. And it's actually been open since the 50s. And so I was like, okay, great, great, great. We can drop down in Amsterdam, the city, for like a day and a half, maybe. And then we got to go to this theme park. And so that's sort of where my priorities were. But we did go to the Anne Frank House and we did, you know, experience the culture there. But we didn't get into like a 3-4 day deep dive.
Gotcha.
But enough of a taste to be like, this place rules.
Yeah. I welcome you to go to Copenhagen because Tivoli Gardens
is a
little amusement park there that Walt Disney was inspired and ripped off, by the way, in several ways. But I think
they
everyone's
say the
fine
same
with
thing
it
about Efteling.
Yeah, I mean, listen, he probably made the rounds.
He was a man that got
scooped
around,
ideas here and there. But definitely recommend that. And it's just right in the middle of the city, so you can sort of do
perfect
it in an afternoon, evening, and then you it's not so far out of the way. I've been to Tokyo Disney Sea. I didn't go to Tokyo Disney Land or whatever, but I loved it.
Disney
Did you go to
Sea
Tokyo
is amazing.
Disney Sea?
Oh my
gosh.
You're talking to a gal who, we walked up to the gate of Tokyo Disney Sea and I inexplicably started tearing up. And my
nothing
husband
about
was
that
like,
surprises me, and I'm not I can't say the same thing didn't happen to me.
Yeah, it's very moving. He goes, what's going on with you? I said, it's just so crazy seeing something I've Googled so many times. And then it didn't disappoint. We were just amazed by it. I cry very easily, though. I cried almost every like live theater performance. We just saw Beatles Love in Vegas, and it was my first time seeing it after like years and years of wanting to, and I was like full on weeping at the power of music.
I get it.
So yeah,
I get it. My best example, my sort of like go to example to explain a similar thing about performance is that I cry at parades.
Yes.
This is a bunch of Shriners playing like a oompa music, but for some reason the fact that they're organized and like carefully marching together and smiling and playing the music and it's live and it's outside, that's all it takes.
I mean, you've
don't hit... get me started on the Chinese New Year parade. Send me over the edge.
I mean, you've hit on precisely the reason why I get so moved by them. I think also maybe because I grew up a theater kid and kind of knew like how hard it is, especially Broadway shows, like how hard is it to mount a Broadway show? You go through the conception, you go through rehearsals, it gets reworked. It's like such a long runway to actually make it to the stage. And then when you do the performance, you have to give your all every time. And it's just like, I'm witnessing all of these people's dreams come alive. Like I get so excited for people. So I get moved by that. And then if the story is moving on top of that, it's like, you know, Niagara Falls, I'm done.
Yeah.
But same with parades, 100%. I want to say too. I get really inspired by people that are doing a thing. And I think also with parades, it's like, truly, we don't need parades in this day and age. They're not the top entertainment, you know, but we still do them and people get together. I don't know. I find it all very
folksy.
Moving. Yeah. I like it when people try a thing.
Let's go back to that, because when you said that you went to Dublin as part of a theater thing when you were that young, I definitely wanted to come back to that and find out what the story was there. Where did you grow up? Where did this happen?
I grew up in North Hollywood. So my joke is that I'm like a second generation Hollywood dream chaser. and, you know, to get more specific, I feel like my parents were both like sort of Hollywood working class. So, you know, we weren't like the ritzy producer people that I went to school with and their kids, you know, were like in commercials, and we weren't like, you know, fresh off the bus, like really struggling. We were kind of in the middle. And my parents both came from the Bay Area, actually, to Hollywood to make it. My mom wanted to be an actress and my dad did stand up, and he was actually a warm-up comic, and allegedly, according to my mom, they're divorced, so take this with a grain of salt, but okay. Allegedly his nemesis is Dave Coulier. which I mean I
Wait,
wish
give me a minute
I know Just thank you process minute. Yes, I wish there was like a bigger story beyond apparently right. You know when you audition for things and you always see the same person.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Dave Coulier was to my dad, where he would just be like, come on, you know, every time. And according to my mom, it was down to my dad and Dave for the part on Full House. And so that would have defined my life in a completely different way. I always joke that I came so close to being terrible growing up.
I came so close to somehow being twins, even though that's not really how it all worked.
Yeah, all the children just become twins, like Mary-Kate and
Ashley. That's right.
Yeah, so, and they divorced when I was four. So, you know, I didn't grow up with them in the house, but I just sort of grew up in North Hollywood in this environment of other people that had come here to make it. And now they had families. And so I kind of, you know, ran around with a group of kids that kind of knew the score. And I look back now that I've, you know, worked in the entertainment industry for a while, I really value that perspective that I had of, you know, seeing like entertainment from that young age and sort of not getting disillusioned in the way so many people do when they come here and they see like the Hollywood depiction on movies and TV and think it's going to match that. I kind of have been able to see the peaks and valleys of different things. But that being said, every other school that you can attend in the Valley growing up is a performing arts school. It's just it's just what happens. And I've always been a very hammy person. I should have known I was going to go into comedy back then, because like in high school, I auditioned for The Crucible with a monologue from Kids in the Hall. I thought there wasn't a problem with that.
What monologue was it?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. It was the biggest crouton monologue that Bruce McCullough did.
I knew you were going to say Bruce because aside from Buddy Cole, Bruce's monologues were always
so
the
great.
Most sort of strange and theatrical and like very just sort of like faux intense or possibly real intense.
Yeah.
So I love this. I love this.
I thought it was great. And I didn't realize, oh my God, I just remember I walked into the room to audition and I went to a performing arts middle school, which is when I went to Ireland. But then I went to this performing arts high school called LOCSA, LA County High School for the Arts. It's a very fame type high school. You have to audition to get in. And I got into the theater program. And I just remember walking into the audition room, doing my monologue, and looking out at like five different teachers completely stone-faced, probably hating me for making this choice, except for one person who I've kept in touch with who got it, and he ended up casting me in his comedy play, but everybody else was like, she's really not taking this whole theater thing seriously. But it worked out.
But some of that stuff, like, did they just, obviously, they understood that it, whatever it was, it wasn't theater, the monologue. But they didn't, but it's not like they necessarily, they probably didn't know where it was from. I don't know how many, I guess it depends on how savvy they were.
Yeah, I mean, but everyone else, I don't know. I don't think that I was like putting on this thought of like, I'm not going to conform. It was just me sort of following what I thought was a good choice that matched what I was into, which ended up being a really good life lesson to continue on as I navigated a career later. But I just thought that it was, you know, it was what I wanted to do versus like a Tennessee Williams type monologue. And I also like never really felt like I fit into like the thespian role that so many other of my peers, which they were all like 16. You're not a thespian, but like everybody took themselves so seriously. And I just wanted to, I like I said, it was a ham. So I really loved performing and I just wanted to have fun with it. So I think that was kind of my quiet rebellion in a way, though it wasn't fully intentional. But to go back to your question about Ireland, the middle school I went to was Performing Arts Middle School. It actually was a magnet in a bigger public school. And every year, the little theater department would have a trip that they would go to. And, you know, usually it'd be like a theater city. So the first one I think they went to was like London. And I didn't go on that one. But then the next year, they're like, we're going to go to Dublin or we're going to go to Ireland. I think the trip was, you go for 2 weeks and you hop on a bus and you just cover the whole country, which was amazing looking back. And I think they worked with this company that just made it really affordable. And also looking back now, like my mom was a single mom. She didn't have really much money. And, you know, the fact that she kind of scraped together and pushed for me to experience that by myself was really, really special. So,
Yeah,
I went to Ireland and it was, you know, everything that you see in movies and TV with like the green valleys and sheep and all these different things. I felt like I was driving through postcards and it was really, really cool. The one thing that the trip did not deliver on, which was the original intent of it being a theater trip, we went to some play. I think it was supposed to be a comedy. But we went to like one play in Dublin.
What an afterthought.
And I know. But we were all like group of middle schoolers and we go to this play in Dublin and their accents were so thick, but then also it was like so slang filled of Irish slang that there was no way we were able to follow anything that was happening. I think most of us fell asleep in our seats. But otherwise it was a great
trip.
So
wait, did you say that it was towards the end or it was towards the beginning of the trip?
Maybe it was the middle actually. I don't know.
So
I can't remember. Yeah. We'd already experienced a bit of the country.
But you hadn't picked up the way to translate a thick Irish accent.
Absolutely not. And this was a time before iPhones, so we were like, "Oh, all right. Whatever works. Let's just move on to the next stop."
Right. What and how did you feel? I mean, was there Did you have any anxiety being that age? Because, you know, a lot of the time, maybe a smaller trip happens at that age, like, you know, student council camp or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then this sort of more international stuff, if kids are lucky enough, tends to begin, I think, maybe a little more often in high school and college. Did you feel any anxiety about knowing that, you know, yes, you would be with a group of your peers, but you would kind of be alone as far as parents and stuff are concerned? Or were you only psyched about it?
I was pretty psyched. I think at that, well, I've always been kind of an independent person, and you know, like, I feel like growing up, my family unit was just my mom and my sister, and even in that small unit, I felt very much like I'm on my own and I'm going to do my own thing and, you know, kind of like forge my own path. And so I was really excited to have that experience. And maybe it was better in my head, too, where I was like, oh, we've been to Disneyland together and I know how that goes. Like, I want to sort of navigate my own with this, even though I was still within a group and had to sort of adhere to our chaperones and the theater teacher and things like that. I was excited for that. But then I also, like, the way that the group sort of laid out was, it was just a small, small group. So maybe if it was like our whole theater class, I would have had anxiety because of just social dynamics, and especially in middle school, which is, like, my opinion, the worst age. High school is so much easier, I think, than middle school. If it was like a bigger group like that, maybe I would have felt social pressures of like what the hierarchy is going to be. But it was this small group. And then I ended up spending most of my time. My English teacher went with us and she brought her teenage son. And I ended up spending most of my time with them, not in a romantic way, but just because, and I hate to say this, but it was true back then, and I feel like it's true now. I was an old soul, and so I felt like I got along a little bit more with the older kids, and so that was sort of mostly my experience with it. And there was one moment I remember when we were, I think, in the airport connecting our flight to eventually go to Ireland, and the rest of our group, I was hanging out with the teacher and her son, and the rest of our group was kind of behind us, and they were just having like a crisis and causing, you know, a big scene. And but we were off to the side, and we overheard like another English person being like, oh, stupid Americans. Mm-hmm. And I got to kind of roll my eye too and be like, yeah, right, we're all the same. So those are my big memories from that trip.
I love that you, I appreciate that you hastened to say that it was not romantic, because that absolutely was on the roster of questions that I was going to have to ask about the trip. Because, you know, there's, I think, maybe less so in middle school for some kids, but still, you're, you know, if you're, when you're getting into that, those raging hormones ages, there can be this sort of like, suddenly I'm passionately having a crush on this person, but possibly only because they are also on this trip and it's exciting, and like the adrenaline of that is spilling over into this crush that will go away in a week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to say that I was a little writer kid too. So I think when you're a little writer kid, you feel like a romantic sense of self. Mm-hmm. Probably earlier than your next person, because you're reading books and they're, you know, like, or at least the books I was reading at that age, it was all like Francesca Leah Block and like things that were very, you know, like, she's a girl in a world and she's magic and who's gonna I always joke that there's like a whole genre of books called Magic Bitch, where it's like the YA protagonist, it has like some magical power. And, you know, now I would look back as an adult and go, well, it's because, you know, females don't have any autonomy, so we have to be special by some outside force. But at the time I was like, wow, yeah, like, you know, she's a clone and she's magic. So I was reading those books and, you know, starting to feel sort of romantic leanings toward like what I should be spending my energy on. And I remember, like, It didn't matter who my object of affection was. It was that I had one, like I needed to have one. Sure. And I just remember maybe as early as like fifth grade sort of picking almost at random, like, yes, you shall be my crush. But I didn't. It was mostly just crushes, like throughout different crushes I would sort of fixate on, and nothing happened all throughout middle school. I was very much like the friend on the side and, you mm-hmm. know, the secondary character in someone else's story at that particular chapter. And that was fine by me. I was happy to be sort of out of the limelight in that way and out of trouble.
Right. With the way you said, and you shall be my crush, of course, like I couldn't help but just quickly imagine you kind of almost like you were knighting someone. Like if you
were it felt like
child,
that at times.
The child who's like, yes, it has been decided. I want to congratulate you.
I mean,
I cannot guarantee the length of this position, but mm-hmm. you will be my crush.
And you will feel it somehow deep in the night.
Say nothing from here, nothing, you will get no indication whatsoever that I am anything other than a friend.
Yeah, yeah. Though there was, now that I'm thinking about it, there was like one moment in middle school, I want to say, where that kind of caused just a little bit of drama for me, where I remember going to a slumber party and henna tattoos got busted out. It got wild. And everybody snatched all the pretty henna tattoos. And, you know, they were just like the temporary ones that you sort of rub on your arm. And there was like one left that had like a little heart and a banner, and like you put the name of your beloved in the banner. And I just remember some of the other mean girls at that slumber party, and everyone knew who my crush was because I was like very loud about it. It was this guy named Mike Lesge, and everybody was like, you should get that henna tattoo and put Mike's name in it. And I was like, really? And, you know, in that very middle school way where I was like, will that make you like me? Sure then. And I did it. And I remember like the next Monday at school, this big showdown on like the playground, and Mike walking up to me, and he never spoke to me, I think, before that, but walking up to me and being like, heard you got a tattoo with my name on it. And I said, yeah. He goes, can I see it? And I showed it to him. I think it was on my ankle. He just went, cool. And then he walked away and never spoke to me again.
That is mythical.
Yeah.
That's like that is a beautiful, very, very like literary moment.
Yes. And it was very pure.
It was very pure.
I think that I enjoyed that too. I mean, yeah, at that age especially, I don't think if any of my crushes liked me back, I think it would almost ruin it for me.
Sure.
Because then that just led to a whole mess of other problems and expectations. But
exactly.
If I was just alone in the corner and being like doodling hearts and stuff, that was safe for me. And I was comfortable with that.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I will be back after a word from our wonderful buddies at Maximum Fun.
Friendly Fire is a podcast about war movies, but it's so much more than that.
It's history.
It was just supposed to be another assignment.
It's comedy.
Under no circumstances are you to engage the enemy.
It's cinema studies.
It's a hell of a combination.
So subscribe and download Friendly Fire on your podcatcher of choice.
Or at MaximumFun.org.
And also come see us at San Francisco Sketchfest on January 16th.
You can get tickets at sfsketchfest.com.
Mission accomplished.
What's the age difference between you and your sister?
2 years. She's 2 years older.
She's 2 years older. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Did she have that sort of, did you kind of follow the same track in terms of the schools that she was doing, or were you guys kind of off doing different things?
Yeah, we did different things. She ended up going to a very interesting school program. She went to North Hollywood High, and they had this magnet called the Zoo Magnet, which sounds crazy. Now that I'm saying it in the year of our Lord 2020, but it was this magnet where you would do your classes in the morning at North Hollywood High, and then you would get on a bus and they would shuttle you over to the LA Zoo, where they had a series of bungalows, and then you would have your afternoon classes there. And I guess, I guess the intention is, you know, for kids that are interested in science and sort of going into veterinary stuff. most mm-hmm. literally, but my sister always knew that she was going to be a visual artist. So she went there and was like, sweet, I'm going to go to the zoo and like draw monkeys. And that's what she did. And she had a great time doing that. And now she works in animation as a background artist. So she did the thing she wanted to do.
How cool is that? She did the thing Very she wanted cool. to do, but definitely not on its face, as you said.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you don't necessarily, like, the fact that she sort of arrived at that kind of like, well, yeah, I mean, I don't have the, like, I'm gonna sort of hack the system here, you know? This isn't why they think I'm doing this, but this is why. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think she had a good time generally in high school too, but then before that, and maybe this was also like some cajoling from my mom. My mom is kind of obsessed with marching bands, not in a way that, like, speaking of parades, not in a way that, like, factors into daily life, but she... My sister plays the flute, and my mom was like so into my sister playing in the marching band. So she did, I think, for 9th and 10th grade. And during that time, of course, we had to go. We're LA family. So she would march in like some Pasadena street fair parade, and she would do, you know, these other things, and we would show up for it. We'd go to football games, really only to see her play. And it's funny because so she did that for, I want to say, first 2 years of high school. And you know, like, by all accounts, like, hated it and made a big teenage show of like, no, mom, I'm not going to do this anymore. And it's funny now.
She tries to break the flute over her knee, but it does. Why isn't this working?
But then it comes apart because you have to assemble.
Good point.
I always joke too that, like, during this time, my sister was also a Hot Topic goth. And so she had.
Now I'm going into it.
Yeah, she had.
Hot Topic goth? Yes, it's so specific and completely understood.
I have many photos, and I think she's just now being able to laugh at them. But she had, like, you know, very, very thick black manic panic dyed hair. And she had the kind of braces that look like braces on top of braces. And she also had, if you remember in Romy and Michelle, the back brace.
She had scoliosis.
But she didn't have to wear it over her clothes. She could wear it under. So that was fine. But still, okay. she had a posture to her that we call was very Barbie-like. And my joke is like, how I became a comedian is lost on me, because that's a comedian maker, all of those elements.
All the ingredients.
But she did that while I was at this other art school. And now it's funny because she had her big rebellion with like, I'm not going to do marching band anymore. I'm not going to play the flute. And now... Lizzo is very popular, and my sister is very into Lizzo. Yeah. Lizzo plays the flute. It's a topic of conversation that comes up very often now, where it's like, Katie, if you love Lizzo, why aren't you picking up that flute again? And she's like, and do what? Join an adult marching band? What is happening?
Wait a minute. I'm listening.
Wait a minute. I'm actually.
You know that could be a thing. You that know if she wanted thing. To put that together. Is she still? So she works in animation. So she's still in the LA area.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're telling me that there's not, she could probably form one, and it would be like, and Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers is in the band.
Yeah,
and
this is actually a great idea.
Get a lot of press.
Now that I'm thinking of it, it's just like the fact that, well, it kind of makes me think of LA Municipal Dance Squad, the thing that Angela Trimber started, where it's like, these are all women who are adult women now, but they like grew up in like dance squads and, you know, dance companies, and they just want to dance for the sake of loving dance.
Yeah.
She could do that for the sake of loving marching band with a bunch of other cool adults. I'm gonna plant that seed in her head and see how it goes.
Please do.
I
absolutely will buy the first ticket.
Great.
Possibly even jump in and just manage the band.
Oh,
I don't
know.
Listen, I don't have that much free time, but it sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah,
I'm glad that we got. Of course, to be totally honest, I have to admit that I was imagining an adult woman also dressed as Hot Topic goth with like black hair. Like, that was the only image I had of your sister, so
right.
I sort of just like stretched her upwards, made her a little taller, and like gave her a couple lines on her face, and then assumed that somehow that visual would be maintained through all these years.
I mean, my mom doesn't throw anything away, so this is something that we could still make happen.
Okay,
of
good.
Her reviving her Hot Topic gothness.
Good. Did you play any instruments?
No, I woefully did not. I I tried to play the trumpet when I was, I want to say middle school into maybe a little bit of high school, but maybe just toward the beginning. It's mostly because I was a big ska kid. So my sister went the Hot Topic goth route, and I went so deep into ska, I did not see the light until several years later. And it was a checkered light. But I wanted to, you know, see if I could hack a musical instrument, and I cannot. So the best I can do is a musical theater sing or a karaoke sing, and that's about it. But that's good enough for most occasions.
But if you are you secretly hiding the fact that you tried a bunch of other instruments? Because for my perspective, and I've never played a wind instrument, a horn, anything like that, that seems very hard to me. Like, that seems hard in a different way than guitar or piano seems hard, you know?
Well, it was, I mean, I will say, yeah, I think I tried clarinet a little bit, maybe even a little in elementary school. At that time also, though, I just looked at band as being a way to get out of class and was very excited by that. Yeah, but all of the other instruments that I tried, I think I tried the cornet a little bit, which just felt like, well, we're just playing the trumpet. I know people that play the cornet are very upset right now.
Wait, what's? But this is going to get worse for them, because I need someone to tell me exactly what the difference is. I know there's a difference,
right? I think it has something to do with the valves. But it's also been many, many years since I've picked up either instrument, so I'm probably even not even right with that. But that's what it felt like to me, that it was different. And I think I did cornet for a little bit and then did trumpet. And again, I was so bad all the way, so it's like negligible that I even participated in this, but I tried my best, and you know, I quit early when I knew it was not going to pan out.
Well, there's something to be said for that.
Yeah,
that a lot of us have trouble getting out of things that we should leave earlier, so I'm sure many of us can identify with that and approve of that early decision. I want to go back to the kind of your kind of origin story, right? Of I really liked what you said early on about being in the industry, the showbiz industry, but not necessarily in a way that just sort of Dustin Hoffman's son was. I don't know why I pulled him right out of the hat, but somehow I thought of him. But yeah, I mean, I think that's something that we don't really hear about as often. You know, people, we do talk about the sort of idea of like people who come here from somewhere else to quote unquote make it, and that's their story. And then if they make it, then their kids, you know, kind of grow up without necessarily the same connection to certain realities that kids who don't, you know, do. And I'm super interested in that, which is probably why you said it early, because you know that it's a wonderful, interesting thing about yourself. But yeah, I mean, I think I want to, I don't know how much more to unpack about that, but I really like the idea of sort of understanding it as like a working class dream potentially. How much of that do you feel like was directly communicated by your parents versus just like sort of what you observed as, you know, normal when you were growing up?
Well, I think that, you know, it actually wasn't really, really directly communicated in the way that I feel like, I don't know, the sort of discoveries that I'm sort of unhatching now with going to therapy and sort of looking back, and you know, I'm about 10 years into working professionally as a writer, which is very cool and great, but you know, it also, I'm looking back and going, okay, well, how did my upbringing sort of factor into how I've navigated this? And I think that the conversations that we would have growing up was more focused on like, you know, being fortunate to have the things that we have and sort of the experiences that we do. And there were some moments, I want to say, where, you know, putting aside all of like the divorcee talk, because I certainly got a lot of that. Divorced parents, you're just always going to a lot of like, oh, your father had so much potential kind of talk, that I had to kind of unpack a little bit when I truly didn't mean to go into stand up. I started doing that when I was in college, and that was kind of an accident that happened, that I was like, all right, I actually like this. Didn't mean to follow in my dad's footsteps. But, you know, when I started doing that, it it was something that I had to kind of unpack of like, well, why did dad stop and what does that mean? You know, I think like having parents that pivoted their dreams has been, you know, a big thing for me to kind of try to figure out, okay, well, they pivoted. Is it like, do I deserve this too?
Sure.
Which is something that I think a lot of other Valley kids and kids that grew up in Hollywood and want to pursue entertainment have to reckon with at some point. Yeah. And, you know, it makes it difficult, but it also is interesting, I think, because it kind of lands on the same discovery that you have, you know, if your parents did anything, you have to land on a discovery as an adult that you are not your parents and that you are living a separate life. And I think I've also been fortunate to have parents that are genuinely very excited for me to pursue what I'm pursuing. But also going back to the working class aspect of it, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way because I knew the kids that were Dustin Hoffman's son or version of. And, you know, I grew up, like I said, going to arts schools and, you know, like every other kid. My joke is like, well, growing up there was the same as growing up anywhere else, except my mean girls were camera ready and I had to deal with that. And they would be in commercials, you know, and so there is a little bit of that flash and excitement that would happen. But I also knew at a very young age that I didn't want to be, for lack of a better term, a star fucker, and that I kind of saw past like the glimmer and shine of that and sort of looked at the humanity when I could, you know, because sometimes you'll meet somebody and you'll be like, I'm just so starstruck. But, you know, I just tried to humanize that aspect and go, okay, well, here we are, like this person's family is very well off and that is their own deal, or maybe this person's family, they're struggling and that is their own deal. And it's like we're all kind of working in our own way. And I think I also recognized early on that a lot of luck factors into what we do out here. And I think something that people don't talk about enough, that of course you can work your tail off and have all of your, you know, materials ready. Like, you know, I got my first writing job because I had a packet ready. And if I didn't, I wouldn't have gotten it, you know, very cleanly. But I think that growing up in that environment allowed me to see, okay, well, it's truly not merit-based because this person over here is so talented, but they're not getting, you know, like all the breaks that you would think that they would be owed. And to witness that very young, maybe it's also because I was a divorced kid. So then I feel like divorced kids kind of grow up faster than others, and they're able to kind of see the adult world in a different way that's a little bit more clear. And I was able to kind of go, all right, well, it's not merit-based, you know, it's just about hanging on for as long as you could. And I also was able to then look at, you know, my parents' story and how they pivoted and thought, well, you know, my mom actually pivoted into working at the Disney company, and she's now almost celebrating 30 years of working as a senior contract administrator over there. And she's loved it and has like made a home. And, you know, my sister and I, we grew up around animation. So surprise, surprise, we ended up where we ended up. And my dad went into a completely different line of work. And so, you know, it's just like all stories are fine. It's not that like the only story that's worth telling is the one where they make it big and, you know, stand on an Oscar stage. So, yeah.
Ain't that the truth? Ain't that the truth? Yeah, I think it's such a weird it's just the weirdest profession for so many different reasons. I'm sure there's weirder, but just in terms of like my own professional experience before kind of ending up where I did, It is so, and I love your point about luck, and I think kind of what we're circling here is this idea that I think it gets sort of, the word luck gets name dropped a lot when people are talking about, like, when humble people, you know, genuinely or other or non, you know, are sort of saying like, well, it was a you know, some talent and a lot of luck. It's this sort of like capital L luck word, but no one really knows what that means. You know what I mean? And so there's a sense of like, oh, is someone just saying that because that's a way of being humble, or do they really genuinely mean how arbitrary everything is? And And to that end, like, in what ways is luck playing a part? In what ways is it arbitrary? And obviously you called out some, and I think that's really important, because it's so true that it just sort of gets tossed out as this general term where mm-hmm. we all think we understand luck, like, oh, okay, so yeah, you got lucky. But when you don't really break it down, it just sounds like maybe that's not real.
Well, it's
like, in show business, maybe that's not even a thing, you know?
It's hard, and it's really maddening. I think, you know, I would be lying if I said I didn't have times as a writer where I would just be crying in my car. I feel like a good car cry is essential to living in Los Angeles. But it's hard because, you know, a lot of that luck stuff is dependent on outside forces. And so I think especially, gosh, if I was an actor, you know, I feel like it would be even more harrowing, because it would be really dependent on auditions coming in and roles coming in and things like that. And as a writer, I feel just a smidge more power with, you know, when I feel really free floating and that, you know, I don't have a net necessarily, that I could sit down and go, well, I'm going to write a new pilot and take back the night a little bit. You know, mm-hmm. of course, there's so many other factors that then have to be dependent on that. Like, who's going to read the pilot? Like, will people like it? You know, maybe they won't. And that's okay. But it is, you know, that luck thing is really hard for especially someone like myself, who is very type A, and I like to have control and I like mm-hmm. a plan, you know. So living here and navigating a creative career is about sort of like surrendering to the X factor that you can't predict. And it's hard. So for me, I've really, in the last couple years, have sort of tried to adjust my mindset of, okay, well, I'm going to control what I can control. So if it's writing a new pilot, you know, I know that that's what's going to help me with that a little bit. But most importantly, it's about finding a community of people that, good days or bad days, they got your back, and we're all trying it in, you know, the same way. It's not about, you know, these quote unquote friends that are only your friends if you are thriving and abandon you when you're not. And I think a lot of people can get lost in that. You know, I get really, you know, icky around like networking. And I think that, you know, like the whole business card sort of hollow networking is just really icky, because it takes away the humanity. And for me, I much prefer if it's like someone I actually care about getting coffee with. And like the business part of it is kind of secondary, because again, it's like, it would be great if business stuff worked out, of course, you know, it'd be great if tomorrow I had all the deadline articles about me and all the things, you know, that are like so superficial, but they do matter to some degree, you know?
And it's that balance thing. You're absolutely right. It's sort
about balance.
Where you place your values and how much at any given time you are relying on those sort of outside forces to dictate your contentment. That doesn't mean you can't be ambitious. It doesn't mean you can't be disappointed or crushed when something doesn't happen. But, you know, what kind of marathon are we running? And you know, what are we hoping our focus has been? And the moments that we've appreciated the most ideally would be tied to something deeper than, you know, a deadline article.
Yeah. And I think that like the working class part of Hollywood, I think really shines in that moment too, because it makes me think when I was growing up, you know, my mom had full custody of my sister and I would go see my dad on the weekend. So being with my mom most of the time, she, you know, even though had segued into this role at Disney, was still having, you know, like she would participate in her actor friend's plays as she is a really good seamstress. So she would do costumes. And, you know, I remember when I was like 9 or 10, her friends decided to fund their own indie movie, and it shot at the Pickwick Bowling Alley in Burbank, if you know it. And
mm-hmm.
so,
there
was a magical summer of going over there and sort of like hanging in the back of this indie movie set. And, you know, there was a really funny photo of me. I think I'm like age 9, and they gave me a production badge, and I'm like, passed out in a chair. It's looking like I'm sleeping on the job. And they like circulated it at the wrap party. But I grew up in those kind of environments where it was very scrappy and grew up in the back of black box theaters and things that, you know, the fanciest Hollywood person would look down on and say, it's not worth your time and effort to do right. this, but it was worth it for those people. And I think about that a lot. And I think about other moments where I remember like going to Costco with my mom and we had turned a corner and, you know, one of the people that were doing like cooking demonstrations was an old actor friend that she knew. And, you know, like having this moment of understanding, seeing it like in front of my face of like, well, you know, it's different for everybody. And sometimes it doesn't necessarily work out to the way that you anticipate it, but it doesn't mean that it's bad. And I just remember that moment, seeing that person do that, not to say that that's the worst job ever, but you know what I mean? Like this is somebody that, I think they were like a big commercial person for a while in the 90s. And my mom, I remember her making that into a big moment of a lesson of like, well, you have to support your family at some point. And you have to kind of like swallow it up if there is, you know, shame to swallow. And I think about that a lot. I don't know. Those kind of things that mean more to me than like selling my soul to, you know, sit at the table of a company I don't agree with or a production company or a network or whatever. That it's really just about your peers and that community and that family that you form.
Oh, it's time for a quick break. I will be back after a word from our friends at Maximum Fun.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we host
Round Springfield.
Round Springfield is a new Simpsons podcast that is Simpsons adjacent. Mm-hmm. In its topic, we talk to Simpsons writers, directors, voiceover actors, you name it, about non-Simpsons things that they've done because, surprise, they're all extremely talented.
Absolutely. For example, David X. Cohen worked on The Simpsons, but then created a little show called Futurama. Mm-hmm. That's our very first episode. So tune in for stuff like that with Yardley Smith, with Tim Long, with different writers and voice actors. It's going to be so much fun. And we are every other week on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
I can't think of a better way on a positive note to begin our little MASH game, which we will do at the end of the episode, which we are drawing to. So let's see if we can get some customized MASH questions in here. First, I'd like to start with a very simple yet germane. Let's say you can play an instrument tomorrow. Give me three that you would love to wake up. Of course, you would just end up with one, but three instruments that you would love to know how to play. You could just wake up tomorrow and you just instantly are an expert.
Great. I would love like rippin' surf guitar.
Great.
I was when I was into ska, I was also very much into surf and was like, great, let's go hand in hand. Sure, I would love to master the trumpet.
Great.
I want to finish what I started, baby.
That's right.
And then to go to the Lisa Simpson of it all, sure, I'll throw in a sax.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Okay, that reminded me that secretly what I'm still hoping is that there will be some kind of weird opportunity where like you are on the same stand-up show as Dave Coulier and you can fully Inigo Montoya and be like,
yes,
I'm going to go up on that stage and I'm going to steal all the applause and laughter that you were going to get, Dave Coulier, because this is for my dad.
I will. You've killed my father. Prepare to die. Absolutely.
Okay. Even though your dad's like, guys, calm down. I'm fine with it. I have a whole other wonderful life.
I mostly say that so people know what style of comedy my dad did.
Yeah, there. Helpful.
Yes.
Okay. Next question. And this again is, I've just come to my mind and it is inspired by your dad. Three. this is such a weird, convoluted question. Three actresses that you wish would have been your nemesis.
Ooh.
If you were like at the peak of quote unquote so-called success in that era, you know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah,
were there three girls that you did sort of see on TV and be like, oh, Sarah Jessica Parker, I wish I obviously all in good fun. I'm not saying you should have been obsessed with having a nemesis, but
yeah,
three actresses from that era that are your pretend nemesis.
I don't know if this, I'm I'm thinking more of like the people, you know, when you grow up and people like name your celebrity doppelganger.
Oh, sure.
And that in a way becomes your nemesis.
That also works.
I'm going to go with 3-1. That isn't necessarily part of the era of Dave Coulier. Not to say his era is over. He's very much thriving as all of the Fuller cast is. I will say growing up, I got Winona Ryder a lot. So I'll name her. Christina Ricci, because again, around that same era. Yep. And then a more modern one I'll throw in, and this is more like, all of these are actually wishful thinking because they're all lovely women who are very talented in their own rights. I'll throw in a Mary Elizabeth Winstead. So we got
great.
The brunette bunch.
Great. Oh, perfect. Okay. And now jumping off of that category, three characters that you would like to play that one of your nemeses played. And now that can, you can name three Winona Ryder roles. Mm. You can name one Winona, two Christinas. You can name one Mary Elizabeth, one of each. But three roles that it would have been fun to play when you were into it and not just doing Bruce McCullough monologues.
I mean, I could just go into the Bruce McCullough monologue chapter of my life from here on out. I will say, so this is also going to say a lot about my family dynamic growing up, but our family musical was Gypsy.
Great.
I'm not sure other people have family musicals, but for some reason we loved that musical, and we watched the Bette Midler one that was made for TV many times, mm-hmm. that we taped on VHS, and the Rosalind Russell one, of course. Pay no attention to the fact that it's about a stage mom, and my mom may have been a little bit of a stage mom. Okay.
Not thinking about it.
I would play Louise, who Natalie Wood played it in the Rosalind Russell one, so I'll do a Louise Natalie Wood one.
Nice.
I mean, obviously, Christina Ricci and Casper, because Devon Sawa was so great. and then beautiful. I will say the cherry on top is Lydia from Beetlejuice.
Great. You know what I realized as I was writing all this stuff is that wasn't Christina Ricci in Mermaids also with Winona Ryder?
She was. Oh,
there you go. I don't know what that means, but I did love that movie when I was younger. So
yeah, I loved
it too. Take that for what it's worth. Okay, next category is three shows from any era that you would love to have written on.
Oh gosh, Strangers with Candy. I think it was the first show that I saw that I thought to myself, I don't know who this is for. Because it is so clearly for me.
Yeah.
And I've been kind of chasing that, trying to, you know, make something as unique and weird as that. Gosh, this is a hard question because there are just like hundreds that I could name and would be great. Let me think. To jump to maybe modern times on that, I don't know who this is for, but it's for me. Documentary Now is one of the greatest shows I've ever experienced. I just think that everything that they do is so completely right on. So I would just love to be, I don't even need to write on it. I just need to be present.
Beautiful.
and have a great time with that. And gosh, the third, I mean... let's see. I named Strangers with Candy. I'm going to throw in a real out of left field entry into this. But I'm going to say The OC.
Okay, great.
Because that was, I think, the first time I truly experienced binge watching. With a community of people. I remember when the DVDs came out, a group of friends and I, ska friends for being specific, all my ska friends and I, we watched
and we
it together.
Are.
Yes. And we loved it. And, you know, it was one of those like goofy friend hangs where we would always sing the theme song at the top of our lungs and just have a great time. So I would write on The OC in a heartbeat.
I think that's beautiful. It's a beautiful tribute to the OC that you've just given.
Thank you.
Listen, we got to get into this. Three yes. ska bands that you can summon at will to play whatever you want. They're your buddies. And you can just sort of like have them whenever you want, wherever you want, play for you.
I mean, the Aquabats.
Great.
Which I'm cheating kind of because I worked on their show. but I
that
I
doesn't
just
count
love
as
them.
Cheating.
Okay. I love them, and I think whenever they're around, it's a good time. Real Big Fish and the Slackers.
Great. And Slackers. Perfect. Okay. Got to get this category in. Three foods that in this alternate universe we're creating, it doesn't matter if in this universe you're allergic to them or you feel they're ecologically irresponsible or they are too fattening or you feel sick after you eat them and you wish you could eat forever but you can't because it makes you feel sick. Three things. It could be as specific or as general a category as you want that in this alternate universe we're going to just give like there's just zero ramification to eating.
Yeah. I'm going to start with something slightly controversial because I'm a vegan and I've been a vegan for 7 years. But before I was a vegan, I was a hardcore carnivore to the point where my sweet 16 birthday, I told my mom, I just want to go to one of those Brazilian restaurants where they keep serving you meat until you are done. And she was like, those are expensive. You can bring one person. I went, okay, got it. Mm-hmm. I remember going there with my friend Taylor, and she went to the salad bar, and I stopped her with my hand. Like I was a mom at a harsh stoplight. I was like, that's a fool's game. So I would love to go back to that moment.
Oh, my God.
And just be
yes.
able to eat as much meat. And, you know, morally, I feel fine. Yeah. This is all plant-based, maybe amalgamation. Yes. Yes. Of it, but I want yes. to be able to have that experience again without consequence.
Great.
I'm also I love ice cream, so I would love just a flight of the best of whatever without brain freeze, heartburn, all the other things.
Beautiful.
With chunks and caramel swirl. Then I also, in being a vegan, I miss pizza because they haven't really nailed vegan cheese yet. I feel like
we're
10 years away from it being real nice. I'm going to say.
I hope you're not right about that. It could be a thing where we don't even know
sooner.
How close they are because they're just going to roll out something. I mean, listen.
Yeah.
People think that like the Impossible or Beyond Meat came out of nowhere. So it could be that there's something hiding behind a curtain somewhere that they're going to suddenly be like, ta-da!
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, gosh, before the Beyond and Impossible, it was just like Boca burgers that were like croutons and they were just so cardboardy. But I would love to have like the best pizza.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be like I'm not a New York pizza versus LA versus whatever. Yeah. I'm like pizza's pizza, man. Just give it to
me. Same.
So
same.
That's my answer.
I love it. Equal opportunity pizza. Great. Okay, next category. This is MASH. We got to get some romance in here. Three people, actors, actresses, characters, cartoons, literary characters, politicians from any time, any place, anywhere that you would like to have sexy and or romantic times with in this alternate universe.
Great. I'm going to start with one that is probably the answer of many women at this current moment. But I would like to climb Adam Driver like a tree. And I want to say, my husband is baffled by this choice. I've had to defend my Adam Driver love. It's been a big year for him, too. He's been in like 12 movies.
It has.
And this is no offense to Adam Driver. I'm sure he's a very lovely person. But he, if we're talking about like unrequited love that I experienced as a youth, he embodies the perfect, source of all of my unrequited love. Like, he seems like somebody who would ignore me, and I'd love it.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, and it's not something that I, of course, I do not want now. Even if I wasn't married, I wouldn't want. But he very much like he awakened something in me that had been dormant for a while.
Completely understand. Completely support that choice.
Thank you. I also have to say I've had like a lifelong, almost lifelong crush on this person. But I think Sam Rockwell is just the best.
I threw
a party with my Simpsons podcast co-host Allie Gertz a couple years ago called Are You Ready to Rockwell? It was a Sam Rockwell themed party and it was amazing. People
That's
dressed
awesome.
Up as various Rockwells. I think we watched Moon. Can't tell. We made a bunch of punny food. It was a real good time in honor of Sam. I think he's the best.
I want to say I support that entirely. I did that twice in high school with a Steve Martin marathon and John Cusack sort of early movie marathon. Put more time and effort into making flyers for that than I did anything I was working on in school, and like went out and got all the sort of foods that are famous and for one reason or another in those movies, and it was
speaking my language too, because two things. I when I was in high school I started this cult film club called Film Corps, CORPS, because it sounded very fancy and legit, and I would screen Cannibal the Musical, and then I would make the chocolate dirt dessert with like the chocolate pudding and the Oreo crumbs. I would make like a big thing of chocolate dirt, and then I would take a doll apart and put like body parts in it, so it'd be cannibalism.
God, that's fantastic.
And I would make other things, and we would watch like Ed Wood and Beyond the Valley of Dolls, things like that. And then every year now it's a new tradition. We just had our second annual party, but in the spirit of Are You Ready to Rockwell, the day after Thanksgiving, my husband and I throw a party called Tom Hanksgiving, where you come over. It's also a leftovers depot. If you have leftovers from Thanksgiving, bring them over. We're going to have punny treats.
I love this.
Yeah. So that's the thing. My friend just told me they have a friend who is his assistant, so they know about it. Maybe he does. The circle's getting closer.
It's getting much closer. Okay, let's get your last.
Get
your last romantic.
I'll do a fictional one. Trent from the TV show Daria was definitely a crush. I realize now he, kind of similar to Adam Driver, is kind of a dopey dude that would ignore me. But, you know, hey, listen, like I said, I just need to crush and I need nothing else to happen.
Totally get it. Okay, great. Trent from Daria. Okay, perfect. Okay, and then final category, let's do three places. They can be fictional or they can be real places in the world that you would like to have a vacation home.
Let me think. I mean, I have really bad wanderlust. I think probably because I grew up in LA and I feel like, well, here's where I'm going to live for the rest of my life. No options there. So I'm always like, I'm driving my husband crazy with being fixated on a different travel destination, per the day. So I've been researching for this question for a little bit. I think Bali would be a really, really great place to have a vacation home. Seems really
wonderful.
Nice out there. I have not been there, but it seems nice by all the photos. I want to throw in a fictional one. Let's see. What's a good... Oh, you know what? Whatever. I'll live in the Good Place.
Great.
I'll have a vacation home there, hang out with Ted Danson, marvel at all of Megan Amram's punny food store names. It'll be a great time. And then the third, I feel like going into... Oh, I got it. I'm going to live in the afterlife town and Defending Your Life.
Oh my God, I was just talking about that with someone.
It's the best movie ever.
I love that movie so much.
Yeah.
Ugh,
he's the best. It's the best. When my husband and I got married, we got married at the silent movie theater, and before we walked down the aisle, we played, since it was a movie theater, we had you know, a series of movie clips that were kind of like around love and all this stuff. And then we had a clip from Defending Your Life where he's like chasing after Meryl Streep, and and her name happens to
the
be
tram,
Julia.
The
so
tram.
I know.
It does happen to be Julia. Oh, yeah. God, that's a great. How did you die? On stage, like you.
Yeah. It's so
Julia,
good.
Julia, where have you been all my life? This is a real kindred spirit situation we've come across here. And
I'm
by
so
the way,
happy.
It's definitely no coincidence. We know that our mutual friend Julian made this magic happen and is currently recording this episode. So, why don't you give me a number between 1 and 7?
5.
Okay, great. I am going to use this number, maybe not in the order that people think when they're getting MASH done. And I'm going to come back with your 100% guaranteed MASH future.
Great.
We're going to see how much I can accomplish while you tell these wonderful people where they can enjoy all of your various and sundry projects, as there are many and wondrous. And then we'll see where we are with this MASH game.
Well, you can enjoy all of my many different projects. First, I have a podcast on Maximum Fun. For years and years, it was called Everything's Coming Up Simpsons, but now it is called Round Springfield. So it is a new version of our Simpsons podcast where we interview people that have worked on The Simpsons, whether in a writing capacity, directing capacity, or we've got some voiceover actors. We recorded an episode with Yardley Smith, which was really, really great. And they talk about non-Simpsons things, other shows that they've worked on, failed pilots that they've had. Yardley talked about, you know, growing up in theater and, you know, what that was like. And it's just all about, you know, the talented people who make the best show in the universe. So you can catch that on Maximum Fun. And on that Simpsons note, you could buy a book that my co-host Allie Gertz and I co-wrote called 100 Things Simpsons Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. It's available on Amazon. And
nice.
Yeah, you can catch pretty much all my stuff. I'm at Julia Prescott on Twitter and on Instagram. And I usually post stuff on there if you're in the LA area. I host a monthly lecture series at the Lyric Hyperion Theater called the JP Lecture
Love
Series.
It. Love
and
it.
Very creative title. But
I
have a lot of fun with it.
My podcast is called the JV Club, so
right,
you're not
right.
really
yes,
so
yeah.
speaking
it's
to
like,
the
we don't need to overcute this. Yeah. but yeah, it's a series I've been doing since 2016. It started in Meltdown Comics, and now it's at the Lyric, and we're very happy to be there. And once a month, I assemble a panel of professionals, and they speak to a central topic about breaking in. So whether it's, you know, how do you get a manager? How do you get a pitch meeting? How do you write for adult animation? I'll assemble a panel of people on both sides of the table, both development execs and creatives. We have a lot of fun with it. We also do Inside the Writer's Room of, we're going to do a Big Mouth one in the new year. But in the past, we've done the Writer's Room of Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Rick and Morty, and it's super fun. And yeah, you can catch that. I usually
Fantastic.
Post on social media, and it's a fun time.
Guys, what a wonderful laundry list of things that you can do and be excited about as relates to our own JP here. I am very excited to issue the results of your MASH game. I mean, listen, there's so much good stuff going on here. I'm not even sure where to start.
I'm so excited.
I want to, first of all, congratulate you on the wonderful work you did as Louise and Gypsy.
Oh, thank you so much.
Very moving, funny, irreverent. Any other right. cliched term that you can think of that a critic who may or may not know what they're talking about would use,
yes.
keeping it nice and general and safe. I want to congratulate you on your fantastic trumpet skills.
Yeah,
just
finally.
Absolutely phenomenal. I don't know if that's come into play at all. Like, I don't know if I know that the Aquabats are basically obsessed with you, so I don't know if they've asked you to join in these various times that you've been able to just summon them at will and have them play for you, but certainly you have the trumpet skills to participate in
Amazing.
A jam session with those with those Aquabats. I said those
Great.
Aquabats like they were like
those
they were a gang
kids.
In a neighborhood and I was an old lady. those Aquabats.
I mean, you're basically like ripping pages from a script from their show. I want to say
it's in the spirit of that.
It's perfect.
Good. I'm comfortable with it. I want to congratulate you on your work writing for Strangers with Candy. Agree with you that it is one of the most unique voices in television comedy that ever graced the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So you absolutely had much to do with that. I don't know how you are able to just like have so much ice cream at will in your mansion in Bali, because it's kind of a remote area. I don't know if you're churning your own, but certainly you have ample, if not endless, supplies of all manners of ice cream, up to and including chunks and caramel swirls.
Thank you.
This feels like to me it's going to come in handy. And listen, by the way, the whole thing about Christina Ricci being your nemesis, I mean, I know that she's a huge fan of yours. She actually considers you a nemesis because she feels like, oh,
right,
Julia Prescott, oh, always, she's so talented. She's always getting those roles I want. And I don't know how she feels about this, but I heard a rumor, and it's just a rumor, and I don't want you to feel threatened because, as you know, you're just nemeses, respectful nemeses. But she, too, had an interest in your romantic partner, whom you can climb like a tree. Adam Driver.
Yes! I won 2020!
That's right. Meanwhile, someone's Googling like, wait, games. Christina Ricci was, yeah. I've started an accidental rumor that Christina Ricci is interested in Adam Driver. That's based on nothing. Nothing. Nothing
well,
except
she
the Smash game.
It's because she's living in this time.
That's right. That's absolutely right. She has eyes. Okay. So that, my friend, is your MASH
Amazing.
Results. I think you have some wonderful things to go off and celebrate. And I thank you so much for doing the podcast, Julie. And thanks again connecting this and making this happen remotely, as I am up in San Francisco for Sketchfest and you are in the Maximum Fun office and recording studio. I am very excited to meet you in person. I expect invitations to every single one of the cool things mentioned that you're up to.
You got it. This has been such a pleasure. It's such a treat. And I look forward to in-person hangs.
The show is recorded by me and edited by Julian Burrell. And as always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.